Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. It's been almost 30 years since we saw our last hurricane here on the Cape and Islands, Hurricane Bob in 1991. The more time that passes, the more we may forget how devastating a hurricane can be. Eric J. Dolan reminds us as he looks back on the history of hurricanes in his new book, A Furious Sky, The 500-Year History of America's Hurricanes. Welcome back.
Hi, Mindy. Thanks for having me back.
So 500-year history, how did you go about researching that far back?
Well, first I took a deep breath because there is surprisingly a huge amount of information on hurricanes, even going back to the 1500s. But the main way that I did the research is I looked through hundreds, perhaps thousands, eventually scanning different books on history, trying to find out where hurricanes popped up, which ones got the most coverage. And, for example, with Christopher Columbus's hurricane in 1502, I was very surprised to learn how extensively people had written about his voyage, not only his voyage, but also that particular hurricane that impacted his little fleet. So for each of the hurricanes that I talk about in the book, trust me, there are many books, articles, personal diaries, letters, newspaper accounts that talk about the hurricane from different perspectives. And the struggle for me as a writer, as any writer that had to confront a story, a narrative that goes for 500 years, is you have to very carefully select which stories you're going to tell and what parts of those stories you're going to share with the reader to keep it going in a fast pace, but also get across the main points.
So, yeah, you can't include every hurricane that hits the U.S. So what criteria did you use to determine which hurricanes you were going to include in the book?
Well, it was mainly the hurricanes that had either the biggest impact on both local history and perhaps more broadly United States or colonial history. But also, I wanted to include there are some hurricanes that may have been just particularly interesting because of the events that surrounded them. But by and large, anybody who looks at the book and looks at the hurricanes that are covered will realize that it's like the biggest hits of hurricanes through history. And, you know, and I know inevitably, I know that people are going to look at the book and somebody's going to say, the hurricane that hit my grandfather or hit us is not included. I get that all the time. I had that with the Lighthouse book. Yeah. Oh, my goodness, A Brilliant Beacons. Everybody said, you didn't include my lighthouse. Well, there are 1,500 of them. It's the same with the hurricanes.
I'll tell you, reading this book really makes you take hurricane preparedness more seriously. Now, and you mentioned Christopher Columbus. You start the book with the voyages of Christopher Columbus. And his first few voyages to the New World were pretty tame meteorologically, but his fourth not so much. Tell us about that and why he was accused of practicing sorcery.
Well, Christopher Columbus, as we know, is the first Westerner to come to the so-called New World, and the natives and others, Vikings, had been there before. And during his first three voyages, he had a lot of interactions, many of them quite horrific, with the local natives, the Taino Indians. But they also told him about these massive storms that occur. And Christopher Columbus actually was on the outskirts of some storms, perhaps hurricanes or tropical storms, during his first three voyages, but none impacted him directly. The Indians told him that there are signs that you can use to tell of the approach of one of these massive storms, including large swells in the ocean, a brick-red sky in the morning. And he got educated a little bit about forecasting hurricanes. So when he came back in 1502, he wanted to go to Hispaniola, but the governor there forbade him, as did the King Ferdinand and his Queen Isabella, forbade him from stopping in Hispaniola because of his checkered history. But he saw these signs. He saw that a hurricane was coming. So he pleaded with the governor, Ovando, to come into the harbor to shelter from the storm. And he also told the governor that you shouldn't let your treasure fleet of 28 ships leave for the next 8 days, because if you do, they might run smack into a hurricane. And Christopher Columbus was a little bit self-interested here, because one of those ships was the Aguja, or the Needle, and on board was the silver and gold that the king and queen had promised Columbus for his earlier work in the Caribbean. So Governor Ovando chose to ignore Columbus's warnings. He also didn't allow Columbus to come into port. Columbus knew this hurricane was coming. He went along the coast, found an embayment to a shelter. The governor sent off the fleet, and within about a day of it leaving, the hurricane roared in, sank many of the ships, killed hundreds and hundreds of people, and the only ship that made it through this hurricane was the tiny Aguja, which had on board Columbus's payments. So after the event, Governor Ovando was very upset, of course, but people pointed to Christopher Columbus as being this sorcerer almost by predicting the arrival of this hurricane when nobody else knew about that. And they wondered maybe he had conjured the hurricane to get back at one of the people that died on board one of the ships. This guy Bobadilla had actually put Columbus on trial a couple of years before and had sent Columbus back to Spain in chains. So people thought that he was a sorcerer of some sort and brought down this hurricane as revenge. But he wasn't a sorcerer. He just was a very skilled mariner who paid attention to the limited signs that were available of an approaching hurricane. And by the way, Christopher Columbus, by making that prediction, that forecast, becomes the first Westerner ever to make a hurricane forecast, and an accurate one at that.
Yeah. Now, you write, the list of colonial hurricanes is long, and many caused great destruction, but two of them are particularly noteworthy, the Great Colonial Hurricane of 1635 and the Treasure Fleet Hurricane of 1715. Tell
right.
us a little bit about them.
The Great Colonial Hurricane, which took place in August of 1635, came in and just leveled the area in Plymouth Colony and the Massachusetts Bay Colony. A number of people were killed. A number of Indians were killed. A lot of the structures were leveled by the winds. There's very famous stories about ships offshore that were caught in the hurricane, one of which had 23 people on board. It was the Watch and Wait, a vessel that was transiting between Ipswich and Marblehead, Massachusetts. On board was Anthony Thacker and his family, and also Richard Avery, his cousin, who was a minister, supposed to be working in Marblehead, where I live right now. And they were heading down to Marblehead. They got hit by the hurricane, and ultimately the ship was thrown up on the rocks about a mile off of Cape Ann, and everybody on board, except for Anthony Thacker and his wife, were killed. They managed to scramble ashore and survive for a couple of days, eating food that had washed ashore and clothing themselves before a ship came by, and they were able to hail it, and they came basically onto the mainland. The Massachusetts legislature felt so bad about what had happened to Anthony Thacker that they gave him that island as a present in addition to some money. He called the island Thacker's Woe. However, we know it today as Thacker Island, which is about a mile offshore of Rockport and is part of Rockport, Massachusetts. One thing that's really interesting, at the same time, there was another ship that had another minister on board, Richard Mather, and his ship survived the hurricane, which really had an impact on American history because Richard Mather was not only a towering figure in the colonies, but his son Increase and his grandson Cotton Mather were very important and influential Puritan ministers in the colonies. So that was a traumatic hurricane, but the hurricane in 1715 was traumatic for a slightly different reason. It basically hit off the coast of Florida near where Vero Beach is. And what had happened is prior to the hurricane, the treasure fleet from South and Central America, this massive armada of Spanish ships filled the brim with gold and silver from the mines and mints of Central and South America, was heading back to Spain. When it got alongside the Florida coast, the hurricane roared in and basically sent all of the ships, except one, to the bottom. When word radiated outward throughout the Atlantic that this extremely valuable fleet had sunk only a short distance from land in relatively shallow water, it was like, it was literally a gold rush. People swarmed to the area, started diving into the water, dredging, trying to recover the treasure. The Spaniards were also trying to recover the treasure, but a lot of other people came there. And many of those people were disappointed. Some people did find treasure, but many of them were disappointed. But they were there in Florida, down near the Caribbean, where there had been, you know, there was incipient piratical behavior. But basically, a lot of these treasure seekers decided, hey, I couldn't find treasure on the bottom of the ocean floor, but maybe I could become a pirate and find treasure that way. So quite a few of those treasure seekers actually turned to piracy, and this is right during the start of the second half of the golden age of piracy, when we get pirates like Blackbeard and that we still talk about today. And this helped initiate a minor explosion in piracy that greatly affected the colonies and Europe as well.
Now, we had Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin both had a keen interest in meteorology. And let's start with Ben Franklin. He was the first person to realize that hurricanes had forward movement and that a hurricane's winds could blow contrary to the direction it was moving. That was a big discovery.
Yeah, it was. I mean, before then, basically, most people just viewed hurricanes as an act of God, not so much a natural phenomenon. And there was no rhyme or reason when they arose, and people often thought that a hurricane sort of popped up and died in roughly the same area. But in 1743, Benjamin Franklin heard about a lunar eclipse. He wanted to go out and see it. He walked outside of his house in Philadelphia, craned his head upwards, and was sent rushing inside because it started to rain and blow with great fury. And the wind was coming from the northeast. So he assumed that his brother in Boston could not have seen the eclipse either, because the wind was coming from the northeast. He thought that the storm must have come from the northeast as well. But then he started looking at newspaper clippings, and he also talked to his brother, and he found out that, no, in Boston, they were able to see the eclipse. The storm only came later on that night. And by talking to people between Philadelphia and Boston, he discovered that this storm actually traveled from Philadelphia to the northeast to Boston. So how could he account for that? He basically said, this massive storm, even though the winds were hitting me from the northeast, the entire storm was moving to the northeast. So that's why he discovered the thing that you started the question with. And that was a major discovery, understanding that these hurricanes actually move in a different way than people formally thought was the case.
Yeah.
And then Thomas Jefferson kept an
extensive diary, right? Daily diary of the weather.
Thomas Jefferson was a true Renaissance man in many ways. I mean, he was interested in so many different aspects of life, and especially science. And he kept this diary for many decades, trying to understand the rhyme and reason of weather, hopefully to come up with a system being able to predict weather that's likely to come in the future. He didn't really focus much attention on hurricanes, but he was part of a much larger group of people in the late 1700s and early 1800s who were just fascinated with meteorology. But even though many people were focusing on this new science, reborn science of meteorology at the time, there wasn't a lot of thought or effort being put into understanding hurricanes. So after Benjamin Franklin's discovery of 1743, you really have to go into the early to mid 1800s before there's another move forward in an understanding of what hurricanes really are.
Mm-hmm. The invention of the telegraph made it possible to get those weather reports in real time.
Yeah, that was very important, especially for weather traveling across the country, for agricultural forecasts, because if you could send a message on a telegraph of the weather in this county, and you could send it five counties over or a couple of states over, you could sort of get a sense over time of how weather was evolving, where it was going, where storm systems were going. The telegraph was absolutely a fundamental invention that changed the face of America and the world, but it didn't have a huge impact on hurricane forecasting because, as we know, most hurricanes come off of, all hurricanes come off of the ocean, and telegraph lines only reach to where the lines go. There were some underground cables, underwater cables, that went into the Caribbean, so there was an opportunity sometimes to tell the mainland of the United States about an approaching hurricane coming from the Caribbean, but many times they still didn't have an awful lot of warning that a hurricane was about to hit.
Now, talk about weather reports for a couple minutes here. Joseph Henry was the first secretary of the Smithsonian Institution, and he really took advantage of the telegraph. He created a map that was a big hit in Washington and actually led to the nation's first weather forecast, which came in the Washington Evening Star.
Right. Yeah, Joseph Henry, fascinating character, a physicist, very famous, very well-known, first secretary of the Smithsonian Institution. He realized almost immediately after the telegraph became an operational reality that here was a great opportunity to get centralized information and to start understanding the law of storms, as he referred to it, or to understand how weather evolves and moves across the country. So he had all these Army Signal Corps operators. Basically, he equipped a lot of them and a lot of amateurs with barometers and anemometers and other instruments that they could help measure weather characteristics. They would then submit that information centrally to Washington, D.C., and he had this big map in the Smithsonian Institution, which had pegs in each state and each little area, and then there was a little circle that you could put on that peg, and there were arrows on it, so depending on how you hung the circle, it would indicate the direction in which the winds were going. He also had colors that could tell you whether it was sunny, it was raining, it was hailing, and that became a huge hit with local politicians who, not local, but national politicians, who wanted to swing by during their lunch hour, perhaps, and see what weather was like back home. And it did contribute to one of the first weather forecasts, a minimal one though it was. It just indicated that a storm that had erupted in this one area was likely to die relatively close to that area and not affect neighboring communities. But from that came the growth of weather forecasting that today is a multi-billion dollar industry.
Yeah. We're talking with Eric J. Dole, and his new book is A Furious Sky, the 500-year history of America's hurricanes. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Eric J. Dolan. His new book is A Furious Sky, the 500-year history of America's hurricanes. So now in 1870, President Grant gave the U.S. Army Signal Corps the responsibility of gathering weather reports. In the end, they did not do so well. And in 1891, that responsibility was transferred to the Civilian Weather Bureau housed in the Department of Agriculture.
Yeah, the Army Signal Corps, they thought that by giving reporting and weather responsibilities to the Army Signal Corps, it would be done very efficiently and effectively because of Army discipline. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case. There were a number of scandals, including embezzlement. There were some people that were lax on the job. There were a lot of poor forecasts. So finally, it was transferred to the Weather Bureau and the Department of Agriculture, and the means of reporting on the weather became more formalized and official and a little more effective.
Tell us about Father Benito. Is it Vines? Did I pronounce that right?
I pronounce it Vines.
Vines, okay.
I'm sure that if I spoke Spanish, it might come out a little bit differently. But Father Benito Vines is a fascinating character. Cuba, of course, is in the Caribbean and is affected in a major way by hurricanes. And he was a Jesuit missionary who was stationed at the University of Belen in Cuba. And he had always been fascinated by the weather, and he had studied it. We don't have a lot of information on his early education, but he clearly was a very talented individual observer, and he had an extensive knowledge of the current state of meteorology at the time. So when he got to Cuba, one of the things that he did right away is he went into the observatory there, and it was in disrepair. And he fixed it up. He looked at all the records that former Jesuits had taken about local weather. He indexed them. He looked for trends. And then he bought a lot of very fancy meteorological instruments, like very good barometers and other items that helped him track the weather. He would take measures of the weather and make observations multiple times a day. He started to create a network throughout Cuba and beyond in the Caribbean of people who were reporting to him weather characteristics and what was happening with the weather. And he essentially, through very careful observation and understanding of meteorology, he came to develop it's like a guide to trying to predict the arrival of hurricanes using such things as the color of the sky, the nature of the clouds, the swells that are in the water. Many of the same things that the Taino Indians had told Columbus about, but now is a little more sophisticated because added to the mix were barometric readings and other telltale signs that a tropical storm or a hurricane was heading Cuba's way. And he was very successful. He started predicting the arrival of hurricanes and gave people an opportunity to respond early and to shelter in place or evacuate. He wasn't correct 100% of the time, but he was correct enough that it was more than sheer luck. And his success in telling of the arrival of hurricanes caught the attention of the Americans at the time at the Weather Bureau, and they actually corresponded with Benito Vines. And one of the books that he put together, the little pamphlets to help people understand tropical meteorology and the signs for an impending hurricane, that pamphlet was translated into English and distributed in the United States. So he was really a seminal figure in the understanding of hurricanes.
Right. Now, in 1900, a Category 4 hurricane hit Galveston, Texas. I think we all know about this particular hurricane. A meteorologist named Isaac Monroe Klein didn't believe a storm like this could happen to Galveston, and boy, was he wrong.
Yeah, he was a little bit arrogant, but he also was a creature of his time. He was asked by a local newspaper editor after a hurricane had hit another part of the Texas coast whether Galveston could expect to be clobbered by a quote-unquote West Indian hurricane. And he basically told them, no, the laws of meteorology make it thus that this part of Texas, we're never going to get clobbered. It's very, very unusual. And they gave the locals confidence that Galveston was not going to be in the crosshairs. But it turns out that his analysis of the situation was very wrong. First of all, he didn't take a very hard look at history. He said he looked at the last 20 years of history, but he missed a couple of hurricanes that had come very close to Galveston. And if he had looked farther back into the mists of time, he would have known that there were quite a few hurricanes that either directly hit Galveston or came very close and caused a lot of damage. He also thought that because Galveston, the waters around Galveston were very shallow for a very long ways into the Gulf, that any hurricane waves that were pushed towards Galveston would break way offshore and all the water would sort of roll away, and anything that ultimately made it to Galveston would actually go around the island of Galveston and into the lower lands beyond and the bay beyond. His basic understanding of hurricanes is not as sophisticated, of course, as what we know today, but one of the things that he didn't know about, because no meteorologist at the time knew about it, is the storm surge and the fact that a hurricane, as it's moving towards land, it is pushing, mounding up water in front of it. And that is especially important on the right side of the hurricane where the winds are going onshore. So this enormous mound of water when the hurricane of 1900 was coming toward, barreling towards Galveston, this mound of water was being pushed very, very high, and far from breaking offshore, it basically got pushed right onto Galveston Island and swamped the entire island and killed at least 6,000 people, perhaps as many as 10 or 12,000 people. And turns out that Isaac Klein's confidence was severely misplaced.
Yeah. To give listeners an idea of, you know, you have some great stories in the book of, with various hurricanes, but, you know, Isaac has now gone back to his house, and there's some people at his house, and you write, at 7:30, Isaac was standing at his front door, peering out into the maelstrom. Suddenly, within the span of 4 seconds, the water rose 4 feet, causing everyone inside to flee to the second floor. In the next hour, the water rose nearly 5 feet more, bringing it to 20 feet above sea level. The tremendous surge had been amplified by a dramatic shift in the atmosphere. The winds, which were blowing offshore in the morning, had swung around and were now rushing on shore, and they were much stronger than they had been earlier in the day. At its peak that evening, the hurricane is estimated to have had sustained winds of more than 138 miles per hour, with gusts approaching 180 miles per hour or more. Wow. Yes, just the thought of that amount of water in seconds.
Absolutely amazing. It is. That's the one, I mean, there are many recurrent themes because you're dealing with a meteorological event that has similar characteristics, even though every hurricane is unique. But the power in these hurricanes is just absolutely unbelievable, as anybody who has lived through a hurricane will tell you. And you mentioned the water. It's really the water that causes about 90% of the deaths and the damage that we see in hurricanes. Wind is very important, but there's a common saying among meteorologists, it's hide from the wind, but run from the water. And clearly this massive storm surge topped by tumbling waves nearly obliterated Galveston, which was called the Wall Street of the Gulf right before the hurricane hit, because it was an extremely prosperous area that was looking forward to an even more prosperous future. But the hurricane dashed those plans.
Yeah. And there were some lessons learned from this. You know, one was they built a seawall.
Yeah, oh, massive seawall. That had actually been recommended before Isaac got to Galveston. There had been another hurricane that had affected the Galveston area. The people felt that we needed to protect Galveston against another hurricane, and there was talk of building a seawall. But then it was killed by that killer of so many public projects, out of sight, out of mind mentality, because a few years later, another hurricane hadn't hit. The cost of the wall was deemed prohibitive, and they shelved the idea. And then comes along Klein, who basically tells them, you don't need to worry about Galveston ever getting hit directly by a massive hurricane. That gave the local Chamber of Commerce confidence that their decision was correct. But with the hurricane of 1900, they learned to their great dismay that that was a bad call back then. And they did get together and raised a lot of money to build this enormous wall, 16 feet high. But not only that, they decided that Galveston had such a low profile, it needed to be raised up. And they literally raised up the height of the entire island by taking fill from offshore and jacking up all the buildings on the island. And after a number of years, this project was completed, and the value of the project was proven in 1915 when another very strong hurricane plowed into Galveston. And although people were killed, it was a relatively small number, and damage to the buildings is also nothing as compared to what happened in 1900. So it turns out that that seawall, which is something that has been repeated in other areas, Corpus Christi, around Lake Okeechobee, was an effective barrier against the onslaught of the hurricane.
You have a chapter titled Death and Destruction in the Sunshine State, and Florida certainly has had its share of hurricanes. And you focus on the Great Miami Hurricane of 1926, the Lake Okeechobee Hurricane of 1928, and the Labor Day Hurricane of 1935. Florida's probably the one that's got the most hits, right?
Oh, absolutely. Florida is number one. 40% yep. of all hurricanes hit Florida, the ones that make landfall in the United States. And each one of those hurricanes could and has been the subject for an entire book. So that's the other thing, you know, in writing a book like this, you have to make decisions about how to, you know, synthesize the information and present it when there's an overwhelming amount of information to draw from. But each of those hurricanes, absolutely fascinating and very tragic. The hurricane of 1926 that plowed into Miami basically brought the Great Depression to Florida 3 years early because it just leveled the city, killed many, many people, and was a traumatic effect, to say the least. The Lake Okeechobee hurricane, I mean, the hurricane 1926 actually affected Lake Okeechobee, but the real hurricane that slammed into Lake Okeechobee was in 1928. It first hit West Palm Beach, but then it roared inshore about 90 miles to Lake Okeechobee, which had a dirt dike around it, basically. And once the hurricane, which was still quite strong, hit this massive lake, it sent waves throughout the lake, and the dike was broken in numerous places. And all of these migrant farmers, essentially, that's mostly who lived around there, who were farming the Everglades, many of them were killed. And ultimately, it was probably a couple of thousand people were killed. And one of the things that the aftermath of the Lake Okeechobee hurricane showed very dramatically back then, still today, racism is a major factor mm-hmm. in the way people react to different situations. And a lot of the people that were killed in the Lake Okeechobee hurricane were black. They were brought back to West Palm Beach. There was a white cemetery where the white victims were buried, and relatives were given the opportunity to, for about 24 or maybe a little bit more time, to identify their relatives. There were toe tags used, they were put in coffins, and they were buried in Woodlawn Cemetery. The many hundreds of black victims were essentially dumped into a trench in a pauper's field, and their relatives were not given any time to try to identify the victims. So it was really a two-class system of how people were treated in death, as was the case then, and how people were treated in life.
Yeah. And the 1935 Labor Day hurricane, we know Ernest Hemingway had a place in Key West, loved his house and his boat, which fared well. But some of the veterans there who were working did not fare as well. And in a letter to his editor, Ernest Hemingway talked about the dead veterans and the horrific scene that followed that hurricane.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Ernest Hemingway, who had been in World War One, an ambulance driver, was very close friends with a lot of these veterans who had been veterans of the Great War, World War One, who had been sent down to the Keys to build a highway to Key West. And Ernest Hemingway used to spend time with these guys when they'd come down on their off days to Key West at Sloppy Joe's Bar, or he would go up to the Keys where they were in the sort of the center of the Florida Keys and hang out with them. And he had a lot in common with these people and had very high regard for them. And after the hurricane hit, he thought it might early on hit Key West, but it went to the north. He was one of the first people on the scene to help with the recovery efforts. And unfortunately, what he confronted was just widespread devastation. The entire Keys, the couple of Keys where these veteran camps were essentially washed clean, and many of the veterans were strewn about the landscape, some hanging from trees and twisted and bloated because they had been dead for a day or two, and there are flies all around, and the Keys, which were so beautiful during normal times and green and lush, were all brown, and death was everywhere, and it greatly affected Ernest Hemingway, and he wrote a very impassioned article that essentially accused or implied that the government was to blame for killing the veterans by not taking action far enough in advance to evacuate them. There were some efforts to evacuate the veterans from the camps back to the mainland, but they were started too late, and ultimately the relief train that was sent down to get them was itself knocked off the tracks by a huge wave. So, and that's a very interesting part of the story. Don't want to get into it now. If you read the book,
right.
It's just fascinating, the back and
fascinating.
Forth decision-making.
Yep. Yeah. We're talking with Eric J. Dolan. His new book is A Furious Sky, The 500-Year History of America's Hurricanes. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Eric J. Dolan about his new book, A Furious Sky, The 500-Year History of America's Hurricanes. All right, we're up to the Great Hurricane of 1938. Tell us a little bit about meteorologist Grady Norton.
Oh, Grady Norton, who worked for the Weather Bureau, was known as Mr. Hurricane in Florida because any hurricane that was coming along, he was the man who was leading the charge to track its where it was coming from, where it was heading to. He also often got on the radio to tell local people what to do, whether to evacuate. And he was a revered figure within the Weather Bureau. He was part of the team that was tracking the coming of the hurricane of 1938.
Yeah, and there was some differing opinions in the Weather Bureau forecasting office. A young Charles Pierce, a junior forecaster, he came to a different conclusion looking at the data than everyone else, including senior meteorologist Charles Mitchell. But it turned out the junior forecaster was the one who was right.
Right. This is often turned into a huge battle between the junior forecaster who is standing up to the grizzled old veteran forecaster, looking at the same data and deciding that a hurricane, yes, was going to plow into New England or the New York area, whereas Mitchell, like almost everybody else, looked at the data and thought that the hurricane, this Cape Verdean hurricane, would do what most of them did, is go up the East Coast, travel around the Bermuda High, and then be slingshotted off into the North Atlantic, missing land. Unfortunately, a lot of historians have painted this as this battle royale. That was after the fact. There's no evidence that there was a major, there was a disagreement, but it could have been just as likely that this guy Pierce had been wrong. This is early on, still relatively early on in understanding of hurricanes, and he just happened to make a correct forecast. But the problem is, his forecast is not the one that they followed. It was the one that said the hurricane was only going to send gale force winds into Long Island and New England. But what happened is that the hurricane, it was very unusual, it traveled incredibly rapidly, maybe up to 60 miles per hour up the coast, making a beeline for the tip of Long Island and New England. And during that time, there were no ships offshore to track where it was going, so there were no ship-to-shore communications, and everybody was literally in the dark. So when the hurricane came roaring ashore in the afternoon of September 21st, it caught almost everybody off guard. They had been told that there might be gale winds later that day, but not a massive Category 3 hurricane barreling into them. So fortunately, it was September 21st at the end of the summer season. The death toll was still quite high, 680 people ultimately. But just imagine if that hurricane had hit on a brilliantly sunny day that started out a brilliantly sunny day in August along the beaches of Long Island.
This hurricane, though, still ranks as the most destructive natural disaster to hit New England, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, by far.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the advances that have been made. In 1943, we have the first flight into a hurricane. This was an interesting story. This came about because of a bet.
Right. A guy named Joseph Duckworth, who was an Air Force lieutenant, he formerly worked for Eastern Airlines as an airline pilot, and he had gotten quite adept at something called instrument flying, which is basically flying when you can't see landmarks on land and use that to guide your flight. When you can see the land, that's called contact flying. But if you're flying in pea soup clouds, you need to do it by instrument flying. And that was a relatively new ability that pilots had starting in the late 1920s. So when World War II broke out, he joined the military, and he was in charge of the Air Force Base in Bryan, Texas. And he wanted to teach his men how to be good instrument flyers. So one day a hurricane was approaching Galveston. The local officials at the Air Force base decided they needed to move their AT-6 Texan planes, these relatively small planes, far inland to protect them from the hurricane's winds. At the time, there were a bunch of British air aces come over from England to learn some stuff from the Yankees, and they started laughing at the Americans, and they said, when a storm hits England, we don't move our planes to protect them. They can handle it. Why are you moving in the face of this storm? And they were sort of scoffing at the Americans. Well, first, Joseph Duckworth looked at them and said, this hurricane that's coming is nothing like the storms that you encounter in England. And then he did make a bet. He said, you know what? I am going to fly into this hurricane and show you that instrument flying can work under the most dire of circumstances. He didn't have permission to do this, so he just hopped in a plane, got a navigator who was willing to come along. They told the air tower that they were heading towards the hurricane, and the air tower said, what? You're heading towards the hurricane? And he said, please tell us your name again in case you don't make it. So they went into the hurricane. They weren't planning to go into the center of the hurricane, but lo and behold, Joseph Duckworth and his very small plane basically broke through the outer wall of the hurricane and went into the eye and was amazed by this. And then he came back out and he landed back at the Air Force base. By that time, word had gotten around about what Duckworth had done, and some other people at the base, including the local meteorologist, the naval meteorologist, wanted to go up and have this wonderful opportunity to see the inside of a hurricane, something that nobody had ever seen before from the sky. So he went up a second time and made it back safely. And what he had proved is that planes could go into and out of hurricanes. And this opened up a whole new area of opportunity because now we could have hurricane hunter flights. And that's actually what ensued in the 1940s up until the present. We often send planes out on a tank of gas.
Give us some intel. Yeah. I want to get to how hurricanes are named. You know, we've had a long time people say, why are they named after women? And Roxy Bolton took issue with this way back in the 1950s.
Yeah, the Weather Bureau, the precursor of the National Weather Service, decided in the mid-1950s to name hurricanes after women. And there's a long history behind it that goes all the way back to Australia at the turn of the last century. But essentially, you can read the book and find out about that. But anyway, the Weather Bureau decided to name hurricanes after women. A lot of women took great umbrage at this. They didn't want to be associated with this vicious, violent storm. One woman, with perhaps her tongue in her cheek a little bit, said that she would much rather be hit by an unnamed hurricane, her house be hit by an unnamed hurricane, than to be hit by a hurricane named after one of her husband's former girlfriends. So the Weather Bureau got a lot of pushback on this naming scheme, because before that they'd used a phonetic alphabet, you know, Abel, Baker, Charlie. Well, the National Weather Bureau said, fine, we've got people complaining, tough, we're going with women's names. And that lasted until the 1970s. But what happened is the National Organization of Women and the women's movement erupted in the 1960s. And one woman in particular, Roxy Bolton from Florida, who was vice president of the National Organization of Women, said we should not be naming hurricanes after women. And especially, she's especially annoyed by the news coverage where people would refer to hurricanes as vicious, nasty, capricious. Mm-hmm. They even sometimes called hurricanes a slut. So it was really very wrenching for somebody who was fighting for women's rights. So she went to the Weather Bureau, the National Weather Service at this time, tried to convince them to change the way they named hurricanes. She recommended maybe you can call them himicanes instead of hurricanes,
yeah.
Or maybe you could name them after senators or congressmen. They like having things named after them. Well, she had no luck until Jimmy Carter came into office as president, and he appointed Juanita Kreps as the Secretary of Commerce. She was a self-avowed feminist, and she took a leaf from what Australia had done a couple of years before, which is start to name hurricanes after women and men on an alternating basis. At that point, the World Meteorological Organization was in charge of naming, but through Juanita Kreps and the United States' influence, in 1979, we started naming hurricanes on an alternating basis men and women.
And women. And we only have a couple of minutes left. There's so much more that we didn't touch on. But Max Mayfield, who was the director of the National Hurricane Center, is quoted saying, "Today's coastal development, along with hurricane amnesia, places modern man on a collision course with catastrophe if the lessons of history are ignored." And your final chapter, which is titled Rogues Gallery, touches on the hurricanes from 1950s to present day. A really powerful reminder of just how powerful these storms can be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, hurricanes, it's just like the sun rising and setting each day. We are going to have hurricanes from here on out. There are going to be big ones, small ones, ones that just miss us, and ones that clobber us. So it's incumbent upon us as individuals and us as a society to do whatever we can to reduce the impact of these hurricanes and deal with the aftermath of the hurricanes by helping to protect those who have been affected. And each one of those storms in a rogues gallery, I mean, are ones that people are familiar with. Hurricane Camille, Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Andrew, Hurricane Sandy, Irma, Harvey, and Maria.
Maria.
Every one of them a traumatic tale that in the end destroyed or upended millions of people's lives. Even if you live far away from a hurricane, you're part of the response because insurance rates go up, money that the federal government sends to hurricane relief cannot be used for other projects. So what the history of hurricanes tells us, and this is a very simple lesson, is that they're going to keep coming. Unfortunately, in the epilogue, I talk about global warming. Global warming has already made hurricane impacts a little bit worse because of thermal expansion of the ocean and melting of the glaciers. Our oceans are a little bit higher. So any storm surge, like a storm surge that would have hit New York a century ago, the same storm surge hits New York now, it's about a foot higher than it was a century ago. But what's even more alarming to me is that there have been hundreds, if not thousands, of studies that are starting to show a relatively clear signal that if we are living in a warmer world, which is where we're headed, hurricanes, there's a great likelihood that hurricanes are going to become stronger and wetter. There's not a 100% cause and effect. We couldn't tell you exactly how hurricanes are going to change 10 years from now if the temperature is warmer, but the mounting scientific evidence is very persuasive to me and many other individuals that the warming world is going to result in more powerful and wetter hurricanes. And that's something we have to take into account. And demographic changes are causing great problems. You're on Cape Cod. Cape Cod is a spit of sand, basically, that is not that far above sea level. And there's an awful lot of development right up to the edge of the coast. And already people on the Cape and Islands are dealing with houses near the water's edge falling into the water because of erosion and the not necessarily hurricanes, but that exacerbates it. So we need to think really hard about where we're building, how we're building, and what steps we can take to defend better against the hurricanes that are going to come, no matter what we say or whether
what we
like
say
it or
to,
not.
Yeah. That's right. Eric J. Dolan's new book, A Furious Sky, The 500-Year History of America's Hurricanes. Eric, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.